Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 266, the Bakkerstroom Boer Zulu Alliance and the death of Prince Napoleon. As the British tried to wrap up their war against the Zulu in South Africa, further afield, the happy sound of a baby being born could be heard in Germany. Not just any baby. Albert Einstein was born at 11:30 in the morning on March the 14th, 1879, in Ulm. His birth was not without drama. His family initially worried about his development because the back of his head was unusually large, and his grandmother feared he would have delayed development based on the sound of his cry. His mother Pauline was deeply concerned when Albert didn't start talking until he was three. Then when he started speaking, he had a habit of repeating sentences to himself, which led the family maid to nickname him Der Depperte, the dopey one. When Albert was five and sick in bed, his father Hermann gave him a compass. The invisible force fascinated Albert and is often cited as the spark for his lifelong obsession with physics. A compass is what the British surveyors carried, so too did some Boers of the Bakkerstroom district. The area wasn't as stable as British Army Lieutenant Colonel Evelyn Wood had supposed. Sure, the hyena Pongola chief Mbilini had been killed, but the Abakolusi still lurked about their mountains undefeated. While the British had gone about their war against the Zulu with some zeal in 1879, the Boers of the Transvaal were seething about their territory being summarily annexed by the Empire only 2 years earlier. The Boers of Bakkerstroom, east of Volksrus, lived on a frontier and a ledge. The escarpment along this northeastern line intersects with places like Lüneburg, Paul Petersburg, Bilanyoni, with Swazi territory further towards the rising sun. June mornings are cold, as cold as the relations between the Boers of Bakkerstroom and local Englishmen. Lüneburg was a Lutheran mission station, and on the 4th of June, the pastor's son Heinrich Filter was killed there along with six black border policemen. Large groups of Xhosa warriors swept back into the northern Zululand region, scooping up hundreds of cattle and other livestock. It was with fury that Commander Chelmsford and Wood heard about what was going on between the Boers and the Zulu along the Mkondo River. The two nations were in league against their common imperial enemy. Zulu deputations had visited the burghers, and some Boers had even travelled to go and see King Cetshwayo Kampandi. By June, reports circulated, there were even more Boers than usual wintering along that border below the icy escarpment amongst the Zulu Imizi of the Pongola. The fact that they were safe confirmed all suspicions that there was a Zulu-Boer collusion. Suspicions were further confirmed when the British found out that the Boers were even acting as guides, leading the Zulu impis in their June raids that had been so destructive. The Boers weren't just watching the conflict from their porches, but they didn't stop at scouting. They handpicked the targets, pointing out exactly which farms belonged to Englishmen or non-Boers to be ransacked, while ensuring Zulu spears stayed far away from Boer homes. For example, Conrad Potgieter moved into one of the torched Lüneburg settlers' farms and had an excellent relationship with Manyanyoba, who had burned it, the chief who was still threatening the British garrison. Other Zulu impis, made up of a few hundred, were also conducting hit-and-run attacks across the Natal border further south. On the 25th of June, a group of 500 crossed at Hot Springs near Middeldrift, rampaging up the Kranskop Hill, killing the Nkolosi people, and driving off 700 cattle. These Zulu raiders were finally adopting Xhosa tactics, which they'd used in their much longer war against the English in the Eastern Cape. Never directly assault a powerful concentrated position where troops are entrenched or in a lager and armed with the latest rifles, machine guns, artillery and rockets. Rather ambush them while they're moving. Chelmsford had been putting together a potent column for his return to Zululand after he had relieved Ishowe. And in May, he began a slow-moving march to Ondini. Ranging in front of his force as it gathered close to Rorke's Drift for the second major invasion were his reconnaissance units, his scouts, his observers. And one of these observers was the enthusiastic but reckless 23-year-old Prince Imperial of France, Louis Napoleon, the last hope of the Bonapartist dynasty, serving on Chelmsford's staff. He was the only son of Emperor Napoleon III, great-nephew of Napoleon Bonaparte. In his first 14 years, he had lived the pampered life of a monarch-in-waiting, but that changed in 1870 when when his father was deposed after a string of defeats in the Franco-Prussian War. Louis fled to England with his mother, Empress Eugenie. Queen Victoria gave them a warm welcome. In 1871, his father was released by the Prussians and joined Eugenie and Louis at a rented mansion in Chislehurst in Kent. A failed attempt to remove a gallstone killed the emperor in 1873, and Louis ended up in the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich. Gentleman Cadet was his official title. Only problem, he could never take up a commission in the British Army because he was a foreign prince. After he graduated in seventh place, he took part in occasional ad hoc soldiering, but mostly lived the life of the idle rich. House parties, gentlemen's clubs, shooting, drinking, foreign travel. His closest friend was the Prince of Wales, who had a schoolboy's passion for pranks and loose women. It was said, however, that as a gifted rider, Louis would have sooner thrown his leg over a horse than a woman. Despite that somewhat cynical view, court gossip suggested that Louis was determined to serve in South Africa to impress Princess Beatrice, Queen Victoria's youngest daughter, and to make himself more acceptable to the British public. Another motive for his reckless bravery may also be explained by his ancestry, living up to the glories of his great uncle Napoleon. Only by proving himself in war could he really be called a Bonaparte. Je me d'envie, de respirer enfin les odeurs de la poudre. Forgive the dreadful French pronunciation. I am, he told a friend, thirsting to smell powder. Alas, his ending offered no such glory. Instead, the sharp metallic tang of his own spilt blood and raw viscera became the last odour he would inhale. In the hectic week that followed the arrival of news of the defeat at the San Juana on 11th of February, reinforcements were being thrown together in England. Louis volunteered his services. Initially, the government was not prepared to allow him to go along. He was high risk, a foreign royal. On the 21st of February, he asked the government to allow him to go to South Africa as an observer. They relented after pressure from his chum, the Duke of Wales. And Lord Stanley, the Secretary of State for War, wrote two letters of recommendation which Louis took on his trip, one for Governor Sir Bartle Frere, another for Lord Chelmsford. He is a fine young fellow, full of spirit and pluck, wrote Stanley. My only anxiety on his account would be that he is too plucky and go ahead. Keep an eye on him, was the main message. A daredevil was on his way, and his favourite riding party trick was to run up and vault onto his horse. This was going to be his last mistake in Zululand. His mother, like most mothers of soldiers off to war, was horrified by the idea. Eugenie was in tears when she escorted him aboard the SS Danube troopship. Standing in his office in Whitehall at the same time was Prime Minister Disraeli, who was utterly against the whole idea. Should anything happen to the prince, France's Republicans would blame him. That accounts for this jaw-droppingly rude note he wrote to Salisbury. I am quite mystified about that little abortion, the Prince Imperial. That little abortion, we thought ugly bursts of insults with the stuff of the 21st century. I thought we'd agreed not to sanction his adventure. To which Salisbury replied, I am as puzzled as you are. Every way it seems to me a mistake. Louis disembarked in Cape Town on the 24th of March, then bought a new horse because his had died en route. The Prince Imperial called the handsome grey gelding Tommy, described as good-tempered and placid, but later it was going to be blamed and called highly strung and skittish. Always blame the horse, it can't argue. Cut to May 1879. Louis is in the northern Natal town of Utrecht, having joined Chelmsford, awaiting the second grand invasion. Also waiting there, Paul Deliarge, correspondent for Le Figaro newspaper and staunch Republican, who thought he was going to meet an effete, coiffed dilettante. Instead, he was impressed by what he said was a Frenchman with all the qualities of that race. Chelmsford's column needed scouts and observers to survey possible routes of advance, a dangerous job at the best of times. Up to now, the commander had relied on local intelligence and old maps. Usually the quartermaster general was responsible for putting together proper charts. Lieutenant Colonel Richard Harrison was put in charge of surveying the second invasion. His 2IC was Lieutenant Jaleel Brenton Carey, who had been educated in France and had served in West Africa, Central America, and Jamaica. Carey could draw accurate maps, and being French-speaking, he nominated Louis Bonaparte to be his observer. First, they recce'd the local area around Utrecht, then rode past Telezeni Hill towards the edge of the Ngutu Range on the 15th of May. A small band of Zulu could be seen on the hill to their front. Lieutenant Charlie Raw and six Basutu horsemen were sent to check, but the warriors melted away. Meanwhile, Louis was like a staffy on meth. He dashed from point to point and espied a single warrior on a distant kopje and went for him. Raw and the six Basutu horsemen rushed off after the impetuous prince, and on reaching the top of the kopje, a few Zulus could be seen making off across the country on the plains below. In late May, Louis once again broke ranks and rushed off in pursuit of a distant warrior, his sword in hand, his servant behind him galloping towards his destiny. This time, Louis was headed off by the Basutu horseman, who shouted, "Halt!" He drew rein, smiled sweetly, and said, "Merci beaucoup," calmly riding to face the wrath of Commander Buller, who went puce with rage. Once back in Utrecht, Buller told Chelmsford that he would not allow the prince to accompany him on reconnaissance missions any more. It was too dangerous. Chelmsford told Harrison to ensure that Louis never left the immediate precincts of the camp without proper escort, the six Basutu VIP horsemen. The work of sketching the felt would now be the exclusive preserve of Harrison and Carey. Then, possibly to keep a closer eye on the hyperactive prince, Chelmsford had a change of heart on the very eve of marching back into Zululand. On 29th of May, Chelmsford relented by taking Louis with him on a final reconnaissance of the route they would take on June 1st. The bulk of the 2nd Division had crossed into Zululand at nightfall. They were camping on the bank of the Ngomi River, Blood River. That evening, an impatient Louis Bonaparte asked Harrison for permission to move beyond the confines of the camp and sketch the road to be traversed the next day. The French Prince of Veldt-Air was on a leash, but allowed out to play. At dawn on the 1st, as the column prepared to march to its next stop at Telezeni Mountain, Carey picked up the mixed escort, but the six Basutu VIP bodyguards were parading somewhere else. A patrol of just 9 men left: Louis, Carey, a Zulu guide who was not named, Sergeant Willis, Corporal Grubb, and troopers Cochrane, Luktok, Abel, and Rogers, all of Bettington's horse. The troopers took 2 spare horses and a little white terrier that had attached itself to their mess. Louis carried only a sword and a revolver, and complained he had trouble climbing on his horse because his trousers were too tight. A bright and crisp winter morning greeted this doomed patrol, and after a gentle hour-long ride almost directly east from the Ngomi River, they reached the northern slopes of Telezeni. This was where they were supposed to rendezvous with the Basutu. Colonel Harrison then joined the patrol and was concerned they'd left without the bodyguards. Considered the best horsemen amongst Chelmsford's entire column, the Basutus were not only gifted riders, Harrison knew they had a much better sense of sight and hearing out on the veldt. Born and raised in Africa, they could feel trouble coming. Harrison had to return to the main column, and his parting words were, "Don't go forward without them." He was barely out of sight when Louis began insisting they carry on. Carey refused. Louis said arrogantly, "Oh no, we are quite strong enough." A civilian was ordering Carey around, and here the insolence of class and of entitlement eclipsed the logic of situational awareness. From that moment on, the prince was in command of this little group. Later, Chelmsford's intelligence chief, William Drummond, was to say, "The prince, who was very fond of soldiering, took the command of the men, Carey allowing him to do so to please him." They continued along the spine of a ridge for 12 kilometres, and in sight of Chochossi Valley, the sun beating down overhead, they stopped. Carey saw a safe spot to halt at the centre of Mhlungwane Hill. Clear views, 360 degrees around. But Louis pointed to the river below. What they did not know is that a Zulu scouting party of 60 men, drawn from the Ngubamakosi, the Mbunambi, and the Nokenke and Mabuto, had spotted them on Mhlungwane. Had the scouting party remained where they were, on the high ground, they would have been able to spot the Zulu raiding party creeping up. It was the next move that surprised the Zulu scouting party. After half an hour sketching the surrounds, the British patrol descended into the valley and came upon a small kraal near the river. It was Chief Sabuza's home. They off-saddled. There was no one around. A half a dozen huts in a stone kraal were hemmed in by thick grass and mealy fields on 3 sides 6 feet high. About 80 meters in front, a shallow donga with a stream that emptied into the Chochoni. Perfect landscape for warriors to approach unseen. Carey did not seem to realize how precarious this was. Of course, Louis was blissfully unaware of anything. The warriors were silently approaching through the broken ground. The troopers made coffee with water from the river. Louis dozed against one of the huts, his pith helmet pulled over his eyes. Carey sat next to him and they spoke of Napoleon's military campaigns. At 3:35 p.m., Carey suggested they saddle up and leave. "No," said Louis, "let's wait another 10 minutes. It was this final decision from the civilian that was going to lead to catastrophe for the Bonapartists. 5 minutes later, the Zulu guide shouted he saw warriors at the river. There was no panic. They saddled up. Carey issued the order, "Mount!" And as the men swung into their saddles, the Zulu fired a volley and charged. The horses reared and plunged, Carey allowing his horse to flee into the donga, followed by Cochrane and Abel. But Abel's horse was shot dead, and he was thrown to the ground. Corporal Grubb and Sergeant Willis made it out of the kraal on their horses. Rogers was trying to run away. He turned and fired, then was assegaied in the back. 3 men were left at the kraal, the Zulu guide, Louis, and Latok, whose horse had shied on hearing gunshots, causing him to drop his carbine. He lay across the saddle and somehow made his escape. Louis was also clinging onto his saddle holster. It gave way. He tumbled. He rose and tried to vault onto Tommy's back. Spooked, it kicked him. He staggered winded, turned to see 8 Zulu warriors charging. His sword lost. He fired at the nearest warrior. Missed and was hit in the shoulder with a throwing spear. He pulled it out and fired again. Missed again. Now he fled into the donga, firing twice more, missing twice more. Trapped. He turned around and ran at Kabanga, the nearest Zulu warrior, who threw a spear into the prince's thigh. He pulled it out to use as a weapon. The warriors stopped, for now he was armed with a blade. Then Gwabukana hurled a spear which struck the prince in the chest below his collarbone, a fatal wound. Louis stumbled, falling backwards, and in a moment was no more. A senior warrior, Hlabana Tunga, delivered the coup de grace, then stripped the prince of his clothes and valuables and ritually slit his stomach as a sign of respect. Abel had also been killed, angering Mnukwa, who led the small Zulu party, because he was trying to protect the trooper and take a prisoner as Trechwayo had ordered. The Zulu guide was caught and speared. Recognizing its significance, Mnukwa picked up Prince Louis's fine sword to take back to Trechwayo. Meanwhile, Carey, Cochrane and Latok had fled in panic, galloping up the hill and ignoring the calls from poor Grubb and Willis until they were on top of the ridge. Grubb then told Carey the prince was dead and he had to ride back to camp and pass on the dreadful news. Wood's flying column was nearby at the Mvunyani River to the north, reconnoitering the road for the next day's march. 5 men rode up, waving their arms and shouting. Buller recognized Carey and asked what had happened, mumbling. Carey said the Zulu army was after them.
"Where is the prince?" snapped Buller.
"I fear he is killed," said Carey, to which Buller responded,
"Then you ought to be shot."
When Buller scouted the kraal from the same flat-topped hill Mhlungwani, he saw only a handful of Zulu leaving the kraal, leading 3 horses away. Where was this army? He was disgusted by what he regarded as abject cowardice. The tragic event which extinguished a dynasty's dreams of restoration to the French throne tarnished Chelmsford's reputation beyond redemption. It also, unhappily for Cetshwayo and the Zulu people, obliterated any residual Zulu hopes for a negotiated end to the war. For the British public, the news of the prince's death would prove even harder to bear than the defeat at Isandlwana. Carey guided a search party back to the kraal the following morning, but Buller's horsemen were already there and had located all the bodies. The dog had made its escape, it appeared, because the only animals that were found were 2 dead horses and 1 wounded, which was put out of its misery. After burying the dead, a guard of honour carried Louis's body on a stretcher to a horse-drawn ambulance on the ridge. A small cairn of rocks was placed to mark the spot of his death. His body was returned to England, where his grieving mother, Eugenie, awaited. 40,000 people lined the route from Camden House to St. Mary's Church, where he was laid to rest in a tomb alongside his father. Queen Victoria paid Eugenie Bonaparte an emotional visit, and later the Queen told Prime Minister Disraeli how well the ceremony had gone.
"I hope the French government will be as joyful," he commented sourly.
Carey was court-martialed and found guilty. Instead of being shot, he was arrested and sent back to England in disgrace to await the final decision about his fate. In August 1879, the Commander-in-Chief of the British Army, the Duke of Cambridge, refused to confirm the conviction. The guilty verdict was set aside. Carey was cleared, but not his name. The disgraced officer continued his military career, but never recovered from the events of Zululand. In a final irony, Carey died in Bombay in 1883 after being kicked by a horse. Chelmsford's time was almost up. He was about to be replaced in South Africa by Sir Garnet Wolseley, but not before he defeated the main Zulu army at the Battle of Ulundi. And that's where we'll go next episode. We'll be wrapping up the Anglo-Zulu War then, and we're into 1880. While that year saw a rapid expansion of railroads and electrical technology globally, it also heralded the start of the scramble for Africa, the systematic rapid colonization of the continent by European powers, heavily influenced by the Berlin Conference's focus on what the British like to call effective occupation. The Boers, however, were having none of it. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform, and you can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. I try not to nag too much about this, but there's also a donate button. It helps ho deport aan die kook en die kinders aan die liewe. Kuya siza ukutina in sala kude. It helps keep the wolf from the door. Until next, goodbye.